Good morning, everyone. It's lovely to see you all. Most of you know that I've been away for most of 2 months, and I was in India, briefly in Singapore, and then the rest of the time in India, traveling to publicize the book about Swamiji that I just finished, that we just published. It was published in India on the condition that I come over there and try to sell it. And on the way, we have a very nice small center in Singapore. So I stopped on the way and with Jamal and two of the monks from India and gave a kriya there and spent about 5 days with them. And every single day of the time that I was away was deeply and profoundly blessed. I spoke about it at greater length on Friday night, and I'm sure that recording will be posted, so I won't repeat everything I said there, but nonetheless, I stand in the context of that experience. Last night we had an event for Operation Golden Palace, which you'll hear a brief report about that later. It was fundraising and consciousness raising, and I spoke briefly. Afterwards, someone commented to me that I was extremely serious, that sometimes I make more jokes. And I guess on a Saturday I didn't make very many jokes. I can't predict what's going to happen when I speak. I myself don't know. I wish that all of my talks were funny. People always, the ones where people laugh the most are the ones where I get the most gratitude. But I never know when it's going to be funny. I think it may depend on all of you. When you feel like laughing, then I help you laugh. But Saturday I didn't feel like laughing. We were raising funds to essentially complete the assignment that Divine Mother has given us to establish Master's work in this area. And a missing link in that is to establish our community free and clear. The ownership of it is not in the hands of Ananda, and the debt on it is significant. And all of these create complications that are not ideal. And many of you know the details, and the details aren't important. But it's not ideal, and I feel that we have an assignment that we have to carry out. That talk is probably also online somewhere, so I don't have to finish it. But I was actually thinking myself about being serious or not serious. In the 8 weeks that I was away, I was blissfully happy all the time. Every single day was perfect. It's very rare to have 8 weeks when every day is perfect. Perfect included 36 hours in which I was sound asleep, almost literally, because of a little cold that swept in on me and caused me to give one recording, which was a few words of Swami's teaching, blowing my nose, speaking again. It was pretty awful. And then I slept for 36 hours and I was fine after that. But even that, there was a grace that descended and made me conscious. In a way, I've always been, but somehow much more profoundly, of how extraordinary it is to find the spiritual path and how extraordinary it is to have a guru. And then we add to it to have had such a mouthpiece for our guru as Swami Kriyananda, who could articulate in the most practical and comprehensive ways these soul-liberating teachings. And then you add to that that we have a spiritual family. And this family that many of you have been part of here for a long time, we've been very fortunate at Ananda overall, in 50 years of Ananda, to have had an extraordinarily stable population. Thousands of people literally have moved in and out. But at the same time, the core has been ever expanding, sort of quietly, steadily. And the same has been true in this branch of Master's family. There are many people who've been part of this this enclave, you might say, for decades. And I think many of us will take our last breath together. I mean, it's really very, very, very unusual in a world as unstable as this. And then I went to Singapore, and I met people that I had never seen before, but that I knew deeply. And then I went to Delhi, then I went to Bangalore, then I went to Pune, then I went to Mumbai, and I saw so many people that I'd never met before, but that I knew so deeply. And I'm reminded of a friend who talked about when she first came to Ananda Palo Alto, which is where she started her spiritual life, although she's since gone on to be in a number of other places. But when she came here, she was a very successful businesswoman, a natural extrovert, which is not that common at Ananda, but she was a natural extrovert, and her business skill was based on her, I would use the phrase, knowing how to work the room. And she'd been part of several other spiritual groups, and she had used her loving heart and her extroverted nature to endear herself easily to groups of people. And she said, she told me this much later, she said she came here and she came because of Autobiography of a Yogi and was very interested. And she just naturally started being the person she'd always been, trying to make friends, trying to make contacts, you know, trying to get to know this new group. And she said, it was really, the phrase she used was Teflon. She said she was like Teflon. She said she just couldn't make any relationship stick. Nothing that she'd done her whole life worked. And after a few weeks of this, she finally decided, well, I've come for Master, so I think I'll just concentrate on him. So she started paying attention more to the altar than to the people around her. And she said, as soon as she did that, all of a sudden, all the other people in the room started noticing that she was there. And when she was explaining it to me, I understood immediately because I myself had watched the phenomenon. Because I was 16 years at Ananda Village, I was one of the founding generation there. And when we moved here in 1987, I was very curious as to what would happen. Because the assignment from Swamiji was to recreate as much as possible what we had in that first community. And I just didn't know how it would unfold, this environment being so different. That was and is a rural enclave, in many ways a secluded ashram. And this is a city center, by however you define it. And I was so interested to observe that the dynamic and the vibration that gradually developed here and has now become exceedingly strong in our community and our temple was exactly the same. Circumstances couldn't have been more different. Swami Kriyananda never lived here. All of us work in many different atmospheres. You drive off the property. I mean, our seclusion is about this big. You just drive away and you're anywhere. But as long as we all tune into the altar, then we suddenly find this unity among us, this way of relating that is really quite different than you find if we're not all attuning ourselves to something higher than any of our individual selves. And traveling around the world and spending all this time in other centers where other people, like me, have had the responsibility for building a family, I thought, what do you know? There it is, all over again. And it made me so deeply conscious of how little our individuality counts in a certain sense. Let me phrase it differently. How little the person that we think we are matters compared to the person that we really are. And the person we really are is the one that God sees and that God loves. Now, in a complete flip from this, when I travel, I always like to read. I love having a Kindle. The Kindle was like one of the greatest inventions of all time to me. I used to have to take half a suitcase full of books, and now you just take this one item and the whole world of books is available to you. So in the course of wanting to just have something to read while I'm here, there, and everywhere, I ended up finding additional books. Let me just start. There's a woman named Immaculée, and I can't pronounce her second name. She wrote the book called Left to Tell. And it was based on the fact that she was a native of Rwanda, and in 1994 that country was ripped to pieces by an extraordinary genocide. And for 3 months, she lived with, I believe, 5 other women or 6 other women in a bathroom, very small bathroom, hidden there, and as a result was not killed, even though almost everyone else in her family was killed. And left to tell is the story that she tells, and she spent most of her time in that bathroom praying. Well, she's written three other books since that time, which give some context for everything that happened there. And here's one of the parts that's the most interesting. 12 years before that genocide, the Virgin Mary started appearing in Rwanda, in a place called Kibeho, which even in Rwanda was an obscure, unknown place. The country of Rwanda itself, nobody ever knew about, and now we all know about it because of the tragedy that happened there. But 12 years prior to that, first 3 high school girls, and then gradually several others, and then one young man, started having visions of Mary. And eventually the Catholic churches endorsed them, which matters only because they're very rigorous about their endorsement. And so she tells this whole story about how involved her father especially, but her whole family was, in these apparitions, that, as they're called, these visitations, and how hundreds and thousands of people all over Rwanda would flock to this little unknown place because the visions continued for a long time, and they would go to be there when the visionaries were having their experience. And then eventually a young man also, an illiterate shepherd man who wasn't even a Christian, started having direct experiences of Jesus. And just really, really extraordinary. And what happened was, well, just to go on, so you understand how she could end up in that bathroom and for 3 months lose herself in prayer, because it was a continuation of the life that she lived. And so there's a second book she wrote called A Journey of Faith, or something like Led by Faith. That's what it's called. And she adds a part of the story of what happened in Rwanda, where both her parents were highly respected. And the way that genocide exploded, there was one day where I think the president of the country was killed. And it had been building for a very long time. And all the visions of Mary, she kept saying to people, you must love one another. You must purge from your heart hatred and so on. She was warning them and trying to gather them just continuously. When her father, when it became clear that this rampage of killing was about to start, her family was of the tribe that was going to be eliminated. And she said, about 10,000 people, it's hard to gather the numbers. Her father was the principal of a school, and everybody came to where he was because he was such a respected figure. And they were in the sports stadium of the school, and there were about 10,000 of them, of the tribe that was going to be lost. And they were all looking to him. What should they do? And they didn't really know what was going to happen. And he stood there and he said to them, I guess over a loudspeaker system one presumes, and he said to them, if this is just a renegade band of people, he said, we will be strong enough to fight them off and we will win. He said, if in fact this is government, the government coming to get us, he said, we're all going to die. And as it turned out, that's what it was. So he said to them, This may be our last hour. And he said, how do you want to die? You know, do you want to die with anger and resentment and separation in your heart? Or do you want to die with the love of God and forgiveness within you? And right there, she said, I think she was still, Immaculée, I think was still there at that moment. What happened right after that was her father told her to run to the house of this Protestant minister who was actually of the opposite tribe, who was a friend of the family, because she was the only daughter in the family, And the women were not only killed, but they were raped. And the father just couldn't bear that thought, and he ordered her to leave. So she had to leave her whole family, all of whom were killed. And she said only out of the habit of absolute obedience did she leave. But she left and she was sheltered. But she said, as she stood there, she said, everybody looked around, and she said, all of a sudden, people were embracing their neighbors and asking for forgiveness from relatives they had hurt and were confessing their sins and falling on their knees and praying, just like that, because, as it turned out, it was their last hour. Now, in much traditional religion, the whole spiritual path is about life after death and eternity after death. When Teresa of Avila was 8 years old, and she was completely devoted to God and Jesus, because she was born into Catholicism and became a Catholic nun in her time, and she was completely devoted to Jesus. And everything was about having eternal life in heaven. This life was just considered to be a brief interlude, and everything was about living in such a way that you could spend your eternity with Jesus. And Teresa was she had a very analytical mind, as it turned out later. And she thought the fastest way to get to eternity with Jesus was to be martyred for your faith. And at that time, the Crusades were going on, and you could go off to wherever it was, and you could be martyred in the war to save Jerusalem or whatever they were doing at that time. So at the age of 8, she persuaded her younger brother to run away to the Crusades so that they could be martyred, and she could just sort of skip the whole middle part. She could just get right to eternity. Her father figured out that's what she was doing and went off and found her and brought her back. And instead, she had to live a long life, completely dedicated to Jesus. But she had to wait until she could get to eternity. Now, on the path we're on, one of the realities that Master brought here is that it isn't a question of a promise that can't be verified. I mean, we can have faith, we can have even a deep experience of the truth of that promise. One of the visionaries in Cabejo was told that, you know, this will be a life of sacrifice and suffering for you, and your suffering will be for the sake of others, but at the end of that, you will spend an eternity with me, meaning this was Mary speaking to her. And so she willingly embraced that because she knew what would come. And she was not killed in the genocide, but at the time the book was written, may have still been living as a secluded nun somewhere. But it was accepted. But the way Master brought it to us is not so much a promise that can't be verified or a hope after death, but the fact that our life experience now will become different. That the presence of God is proved by joy in the moment. And it isn't just a question of what happens after we die, but it's a question of who we are now and living our lives in harmony, that the infallible presence of God is proven by the inner joy that we have. But that doesn't make us really that different. You know, it's more basing our faith on experience rather than dogma. But it doesn't make the everyday events of our life any more important than they are from the point of view of this is just a passing period and eternity is what really counts. Because we're only here for our consciousness. And it's so easy to lose track of that. And there's another part to it which I really don't know. I don't exactly know how to think about this. Those apparitions came, those appearances of Mary came to bring people together, to strengthen their faith, and there were many references. And in fact, the visionaries, these high school girls, were given messages that they had to go to deliver to the politicians. And the messages were, you know, you must stop this hate that you're building. But they didn't. The messages didn't work. Now, we live in very confusing times. And we also live under the shadow, or under the umbrella, you might say, of the fact that Master himself told us in 1952, Yogananda said, you know, that there will be very difficult times that this country and this world will have to go through. And you don't have to be a prophet to sort of see the tensions and the separations and the everything is just building. It hasn't reached the level yet that we saw in Rwanda, but you see that that trend is going there. And at the same time, there is this powerful spiritual force, this extraordinary spiritual force that is awakening souls everywhere. And we can't help but think naturally that the more spiritual we'll be, the more we'll be saved. I had actually, I wouldn't elevate it to the level of an argument, but it was close to that, with a man that I met in India who was quite keen on what we were doing and actually ended up at our program. I was his first contact. The program I gave was his first contact. But he had a very strong idea, because I ended up for, I think it was sort of casually afterward, or maybe it was in the middle of my talk, I mentioned Master's prophecies and about difficult times that we may face. Master spoke of natural cataclysms. He spoke of man-made conflict. He spoke of economic issues in 1952. And Swamiji would often talk about them. In fact, Swamiji would talk about them so often that every time he came to visit here, we would pray that he wouldn't talk about it anymore. You know, we'd all pray that he would just talk about something more cheerful. But almost every time he would remind us that this was, that, you know, this possibility was there. And this man and I had a strong disagreement, because he was persuaded that the more we talk about it, the more likely it is to happen. I said, I don't know what to do about that. I said, I understand that and I hear you, but this started with Yogananda and was carried on by Kriyananda, and I don't feel that I'm in a position to just disregard what they say. Now, I'm not, I don't have clear conclusions on any of this, but realizing how much energy Jesus and Mary, who, of course, it's hard to dispute their authority, were pouring into Rwanda and pouring into many people who later died. You know, they weren't saved, but they were able to face what came to them with this profound and deep faith in God. So what is really good and bad karma? You know, what is really victory? What is really defeat? And this one woman, Immaculée, she was saved, and a small percentage of her tribe were saved, and she herself has carried on this huge worldwide campaign to inspire people to love God. Her devotion is to Mary, her devotion is to the rosary, her devotion is to Jesus, but who cares? And even Mary herself said repeatedly, any way that you love God, in the visions, any way that you love God is loving God. You know, all of these little things that we're using to divide ourselves, whether they are different faiths, different languages, different cultures, or our best friends not quite treating us the way we want them to. You know, we have all these different ways that we find to keep our hearts small. And I know it's not simple. You know, I've lived long enough to realize that deep-seated suffering is deep-seated. That we all walk through this world. Well, Swami once said it's a hospital. It's an ambulatory hospital is what he called it once. This whole planet. You know, we don't come here. We don't need to incarnate unless something in us isn't finished. So everybody's walking around unfinished. And everybody's picture is a little different. You know, sound healers can tell in your voice what tones of the om are missing. Psychics can see in our chakras which chakras are blocked. Or readers can see where the dark colors are. I mean, but what difference does it make? We all are just walking around trying to fulfill the unfulfilled part of us. And looking out at any group of people. And having been around the world where the rooms and the audiences and the atmospheres and the accents, you know, were different, but in a very short period of time, everybody's just the same. Now, the karmic conditions are different. You know, I began to laugh. In America, gradually over time, there was one question that began to be asked. I realized it was the same question, and it was often asked in a whole lot of different ways. But the question is, isn't there a faster, more efficient way to get to God? You know, isn't there a shortcut that you could tell me? You know, isn't there a way I can just sort of skip ahead of the crowd? You know, this kind of way of doing it. In India, the question is, my family. And it would just go on about my family, because that's the particular karma that's there, is these very elaborate and often very complicated biological and marriage relationships. But all it was I long for fulfillment, and circumstances are preventing me. And where will I find it? And then somehow it crosses our mind. And it's not really a mystery. God is always listening. He's just always listening. I had the great honor of writing the book that we ended up calling Loved and Protected, Stories of Miracles and Answered Prayers. And I created that book by interviewing people. And I sent the word out almost entirely through the Ananda world and asked if people would talk to me. And I mostly talked to people in person, occasionally on the phone, but I traveled through the Ananda world here and I talked to people. And they would just tell me in sometimes extraordinarily self-revealing ways what had happened between them and God. And whether it was Master or Jesus or Mary or Divine Mother. And I, because I could take notes without looking at my hands, it would just be eye to eye. And, you know, people would begin to speak to me about what they'd experienced. And then, of course, they would themselves go deeper and deeper into it. And looking, you know, into people's eyes, as Swamiji said, not at their eyes, but through their eyes, you know, it would be like this gradually expanding light. And it was the same light, whether the face I was looking at was ravaged by wrong living, or young and fresh, or contented, or still filled with anxiety. It didn't make any difference, because through the window to the soul, you would see this ever-expanding light. And everything else, it just faded into insignificance. And all the thought of separation or uniqueness or God's uniquely chosen, it all seemed ludicrous in the context of what people actually experienced. And more than ever, through the last few months I've had, you know, it just, circumstances are not simple. You know, some of the Indian cities are quite remarkable. Some of the stories that people were telling me about the challenges that life puts in front of us. You know, some people I've known for a long time, some I've just met, but the challenges that life puts in front of us, it's almost at times unbearable. Unbearable to hear. You know, when it's one's own karma, it's just who you are. But the fact that God is always moving us from where we are to where he knows we need to go. And whatever that pathway is, he's just going to pull us through it. And everything seems to matter, except it doesn't matter at all. Because all that matters is the expanding light that is visible through the soul. So ever since I read, which was a few weeks ago, about Immaculée's father speaking to those thousands of people who were in the last, as it turned out, were in the last hours of their lives, who are about to die in the most extraordinary circumstances, I would think, huh, either we'll live or we'll die. But the question is not whether we die, because inevitably we will. And it doesn't have to be physical death. Either things will come out the way we want them to, or they won't. To lose what we have is a form of death. To lose an important self-definition is a form of death. It's constant. It's not a question of whether. It's a question of how we will be when that happens. Because in the end, actually in the beginning and in the middle too, that's all that matters. Is the light expanding within us, or are we closing ourselves down to that light? That's all. When Mother Mary appeared to those visionaries, they would lose complete connection with everything, absolutely everything. But there were, over time, there were thousands of people there. But all the visionaries would see was a field of beautiful flowers. Isn't that something? And they would know, I presume, because they would be there. The visions were always announced. Mary would say, I'll see you again on such and such a day. And so the next time they would all be gathered. And so they would be there before she came, the visionaries, and they could see these thousands of people. But as soon as Mary came, they forgot everything, and all they would see was a field of flowers. Beautiful flowers. But some of them were more vibrant, some of them were struggling. And then oftentimes they would have all these bottles of water there that became holy water because they were blessed. Sometimes the visionaries would walk into the crowd to water the flowers. And that's what they thought they were doing. It was only afterwards that they would realize what they'd done, because the whole world disappeared. And they'd water the flowers like this. They were seeing it as she saw it, in other words. The world changed from being what we think it is to the way God himself sees us. We're all just a beautiful meadow of flowers. Some of us are standing up strong and reaching toward the sun. But the visionary said, even though the flowers were different, Mary's love for them was exactly the same. Isn't that wonderful? If you knew how much God loves you, you would die for joy. That was what the French curate said. And isn't that just incredible to contemplate? None of it is a shortcut. And none of it gets us out of our karma. But all of it gives us purpose, meaning, and a way to travel through it without losing touch with who we really are and with God's presence within us. Bless you all.
Strong.